B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, July 1st, 2020. I'm back in the saddle after a day off yesterday, and we have a live report from Seattle. News broke early this morning that Seattle police moved in to break up the Capitol Hill organized protest, also known as CHOP. And our correspondent, Jonah Leto, is on the ground. Jonah, tell us what happened today.
All right. At approximately 5:30 a.m. Wednesday, an advancing phalanx of police brandishing batons and pepper spray canisters, joined by a federal judge, cleared out the four-block CHOP, as well as the nearby Cal Anderson Park. Police arrested at least 32 people, unable to flee, and police also set up perimeters larger than the CHOP was at any time, covering around 16 blocks. Businesses within the area are effectively closed, and the Seattle Times reports that any people wishing to leave the area must exit through the southern border on Pike Street. Journalists for The Stranger are not allowed to access their offices on 11th and Pine, and The Stranger provides a lot of detailed coverage on the events. Mm-hmm. Seattle maintenance workers were also observed starting to dismantle the giant wooden fence approximately 20 feet tall around Cal Anderson Park, and it was a recognizable symbol of the CHOP. Government workers are also seemingly tearing down protester statues. On the ground, it appears the CHOP has been displaced, but CHOP organizers like Nadia Miller, for example, have long said that the CHOP is not a specific geographic area, but a movement that continues on. The heart of the movement has moved to the streets surrounding what might be described as the Seattle Police Autonomous Zone, or SPAZ, where patrons are not able to visit even bagel shops open every day during CHOP, and some apartment residents were photographed fleeing the area with luggage as at least temporary refugees. Seattle Parks Department and Transportation employees are busy painting over artwork and graffiti with a neutral dark beige color. Spontaneous demonstrations are developing at locations like Broadway and Pine as demonstrators go to the new borders established by the SPAZ. Police at least six perimeters were asked for permission to go to the bagel shop, but they declined at the time. Police do not say when the businesses will open, but they assume it won't be too many days. Reaction to the forced displacement of CHOP and local residents and businesses is mixed. Some consider disbanding CHOP to be necessary, and they look the other way or are left speechless with the irony that only now are businesses closed and residents blocked. But the critique of the CHOP had been that it has interfered with businesses and residents. To the extent that interference existed during CHOP, it is greatly amplified now because of the SPAZ set up by the Seattle police. Other residents and especially protesters appreciate that the problems alleged to have been created by CHOP are now amplified by police reasserting full control of the area. For protesters, this action follows a clear and nearly universal pattern. Police create a situation and then blame the consequences solely on protesters. This happened with the creation of CHOP, which occurred because of a surprise police abandonment of the East Precinct. It happened with each and every shooting that emanated from outside CHOP and was directed at CHOP, but the existence of CHOP was blamed for the violence. And now business closures are, and displacement of residents is blamed on the need to get rid of CHOP, as if cleaning up an area looking like a farmer's market requires some sort of privacy. The Seattle Times quotes a man providing stark contrast between the feelings of safety and community he experienced within CHOP and the violent attacks on CHOP that were nevertheless blamed by the media on CHOP. They are quoted as saying, a man named Jay, who was homeless and stayed at the encampment in Cal Anderson for 2 weeks, said he was sorry to leave. Other places are sketchy, but I felt safe here, he said. This place was based on respect. I don't know where I'm going to go. Bottom line is, the Seattle Police Autonomous Zone is creating refugees, closing businesses, and tearing down protest statues and artwork today. They consider this a restoration of order and, as with cases of police brutality, they blame the victims for making police actions necessary.
Well, Jonah, it is really good to have you on the scene there, and you've been filing reports with us for the past week or so. And the mayor, Jenny Durkin, and the police chief, Carmen Best, I believe is her name, have been threatening to bust up the CHOP for several days. I think the threats began in earnest on Saturday or Sunday. Was there any more immediate indication that today was the day they chose to take action?
Apparently there were some warnings yesterday, an executive order filed by Durkin around 9 p.m., which I do not believe got into the media zeitgeist until today.
Mm-hmm. And the police chief said that enough is enough. I don't have a timeline for that quote, and this is an article at the Washington Post published today. She clearly resisted the tolerance that was extended, at least temporarily, by Mayor Durkin. In the end, do you see that she won the argument with the mayor?
Well, I'd say in a way, yes. Although I think in a way, besides Durkin, there is a bit of resistance from other public officials who are not so quick to say that the CHOP is just some radical zone or just an irresponsible block party. But I would say that Durkin's stance has seemingly changed over time, mm-hmm. especially with the filing of the executive order.
Did Governor Inslee keep his hands off?
Yeah. Overall, Inslee seemed to be pretty unaware of the situation at large.
Mm-hmm. Now, the basis, or you might call it a pretext, for the bust-up of CHOP today is that there were four shootings and that there have been fatalities involved in some of those. And in the reports that you provided us, you made it very clear that the shooting occurred from individuals outside of the protest zone and into it. Yet the mere basis fact that there were some shootings is treated as an argument that the CHOP was the source of the violence. It created a provocation. Has there been any active investigation, for example, to find the driver of that white Jeep Cherokee that you reported appeared to be the source for the shootings of the two teenagers, one of whom died?
There has been some investigation, but they seemed very brief and tentative, particularly around the vehicle. But besides that, it does seem to be an example of police blaming the protesters for being victims. For example, at around 5 today, police have apparently been armed with pepper spray, and they used rubber bullets on the CHOP community against federal court order.
And so as this, at least this episode, is winding down, do you feel that the spirit and the movement that was really graphically presented by CHOP will continue? And do you see it kind of morphing into different forms of expression?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of art, and there's a lot of rage going on right now, where people are holding demonstrations as we speak and marching right now, especially towards City Hall to protest the current taking of CHOP.
And how do you currently view Mayor Jenny Durkin? Because she made soothing noises at first of tolerance, calling this kind of a new summer of love, and let's listen to the protester. It seems that she has shifted her position. And what are the driving forces behind that, Jonah?
I'd say that I don't feel too good about Durkin. I think, in particular, even before the establishment of the CHOP, protesters were very critical of Durkin and wished for her to resign. That may have been it, perhaps an instigation for her to change her stance. Perhaps Carmen Best could have had a bit of an involvement or change to her stance, which I find to be sort of a, I suppose you could say, betrayal of the people.
Mm-hmm. And did Police Chief Best use anything that you would consider to be trickery or lies to, address the protest itself and to rationalize the police action today?
Yes, I'd say she used some manipulative language, particularly in her interview at CHOP with the media, particularly citing that Black Lives Matter is being said by people who have apparently killed black people, which is very manipulative, particularly about current stories
mm-hmm.
that have not been properly investigated at all.
Jonah, as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I'd like to say that this is just beginning, and I would like to maintain this energy, especially as we go through the year. Hopefully, as we go through November and reevaluate who exactly should be in charge of our nation, who exactly we should be looking up to, and how we can hold people accountable.
Well, Jonah, your on-the-scene reporting is extremely valuable, and I appreciate that. And I'd like to tell our listeners that early next week, I'm going to record an in-depth interview podcast with you to recap the entire sequence of events over the past few weeks and the remarkable community that occupied Capitol Hill during this period of time. And we hope that some of the articulated demands and goals that the protesters have stated will be addressed sooner than later. Jonah Leto, on the scene in Seattle, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And as I mentioned, we will be producing that podcast next week, and you can look for it here at peterbcollins.com. While we're talking about police actions, there's an interesting recap at The Guardian today about the recent shootings by members of Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. And I think it's a useful look at a very large agency that covers a massive geography, 9,000 patrolmen or officers in the ranks of the L.A. County Sheriff. Their budget is over $3 billion a year. And we recently covered the police, the sheriff's shooting of Andre Guardado, who was a security officer at an auto body shop, and he fled the police, fearing them, and was shot in the back. And the department has come under a lot of fire for that and for the case of Robert Fuller, the man whose dead body was found swinging from a tree in the Palmdale community of North Los Angeles County. And the department has killed 6 people since the start of the anti-brutality protests in May. And it is a long embattled agency that has been responsible for many uninvestigated or unaccountable events. The current district attorney, who's being challenged by George Gascon, the former district attorney of San Francisco, who has returned to Los Angeles to try to unseat the incumbent, Jackie Lacey. She has been the district attorney, I think, for at least 2 terms, and she has filed criminal charges only once for an on-duty shooting by a sheriff's department officer in 2018. And Alex Villanueva, who is the current sheriff, the predecessor is currently residing in a U.S. prison for corruption. Villanueva vowed to clean up the department, but he has made every move in the opposite direction. He closed internal misconduct investigations before they were finished, including cases involving deputies accused of crimes like domestic violence, sexual assault of prisoners, and child abuse. He broke a campaign promise by continuing to allow the local jails to collaborate with ICE. He has defied subpoenas, stonewalled the inspector general, and recently attacked politicians trying to hold him accountable on Twitter. So I think that's a pretty good recap of the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. The story that has the mainstream media in overdrive these days is one that I dub Russian Bountygate, because, as we will get to in a moment, when you take a critical look at the reporting of the New York Times, which began covering this story last Friday night, it is based entirely on anonymous officials who are in the intelligence community, and the substance, if you could call it that, is that based on interviews with captured Taliban fighters, the argument is that Russia has been paying the Taliban bounties in order to kill Americans and other so-called coalition fighters in Afghanistan. And this raises so many questions. But first, let's cover the mainstream media narrative. So the story has advanced a little bit today as the New York Times says that it was transfers of cash from the GRU to the Taliban through the so-called Hawala system. And maybe you know about this, but under Islam, banking is forbidden. And so there are these individuals who run a network. And basically, if we, you know, call it person one is in Jerusalem and person two is in Amman, Jordan, I could go to person one and pay them $100. And they don't send $100 to Amman, Jordan. They just talk to their contact there and say, well, pay $100 to the person that Peter has designated. That is Hawala. And so they are saying that the GRU used that informal system to pass what are described as large amounts, but they don't give us any numbers, of cash that ended up in the coffers of the Taliban. Three American officials described in confirmed details, says the Times, about the basis for the assessment, spoke on the condition of anonymity. Yes, of course. So we have no known sources for the story. This is a total trust me episode of yellow journalism. And I have to say that Trump, it's hard to call him credible or believable, but his claim that he was not briefed on this matter, despite the reporting of the Times and the Washington Post to the contrary, is consistently backed up by other officials. Now, would John Ratcliffe, the new director of national intelligence, lie for Donald Trump? Of course he would. Would his national security advisor? Oh, yeah. And would the top spokesman of the Pentagon? Well, this puts us in a pickle here, because do you believe the unproven claims attributed to anonymous sources published in corporate media accounts, or do you believe the Trump administration? And boy, I can tell you it gives me a headache. But I think that we have to balance these competing unproven claims. And it's, boy, it's really hard to pick one, I just have to say. And then listen to this speculative account. Investigators are said to be focused on at least two deadly accounts on American soldiers in Afghanistan, one the April 2019 bombing outside Bagram Air Base that killed three Marines, and another case that is not detailed here. So, this is hardly, you know, a wave of deadly attacks on Americans that can be attributed to the dangling of cash by Russia over Taliban fighters. And when we get to some of the critiques of this new scandal, you'll hear other arguments as well. So here is what I consider to be vitriol from an opinion piece attributed to Greg Sargent in today's Washington Post. Trump is now defending himself not just by claiming he wasn't briefed on that intelligence or by just contesting the significance of it. Instead, he's declaring the entire story simply doesn't exist. He's suggesting no intelligence actually indicated anything like this. So this sounds quite damaging, and Greg Sargent uses the term incriminating. This defense is itself deeply self-incriminating, he says. It only underscores what critics are saying, that at minimum, Trump should be taking this intelligence seriously, trying to get to the bottom of what it actually does indicate, and if it does, to do something about it. And then to further damage Trump's self-inflicted wounds, after a tweet where he says that this is entirely made up and suggests it could be a hoax, Greg Sargent notes, moments later, Trump reposted a tweet vowing to veto the Defense Authorization Bill if it renames military installations named after Confederate generals. This juxtaposed Trump's defense of monuments to traitors alongside his blithe unconcern about a foreign power potentially paying for the killing of Americans. Now, that is just so unhinged on the part of the commentary here. Because Trump does a lot of things that are nonsensical, and one thing is not linked to the next. He is a highly non-sequential thinker. And so to try to tie those things together in this effort to paint Trump as a traitor and a guy who's derelict of his duty, well, that suggests to me that they see this as simply another convenient way to use Russia to beat up Donald Trump. So here's another quote here. Trump is denying that the story has any significance. In a second tweet, he noted he was never briefed about the bounties because any info that they may have had wasn't corroborated. Then he said the story is made up by fake news. Then Sargent notes, note the may have had. His only instinct is to cast doubt on the very existence of any such intelligence, not to further explore what it might indicate. But this intelligence is uncorroborated, unproven, unsourced, and yet it is treated as fact by the corporate media outlets in concert. Last night I heard Rachel Maddow talking about how the Times reported it, and then the Post, and then the Wall Street Journal, and then MSNBC. But they're all talking to the same anonymous source or sources. It's not as if these are independent and individual accounts. They are simply repeating each other's reporting and then claiming that by turning up the volume, that it has been proven, that it's been substantiated. And so Greg Sargent then quotes what I just told you from today's New York Times about the hawala, you know what I mean, those payments. And again, this is treated as fact when that whole, you know, transfer of money is highly speculative. So one more piece. This is also from the Washington Post. And it relates to Trump's denials today. President Trump continued to insist that reports of Russia offering bounties to Taliban-linked militants to kill U.S. personnel in Afghanistan were fake news. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien reiterated during a television interview that national security officials decided not to present Trump with unverified intelligence regarding Russia's purported plans, but indicated that they took the situation seriously enough to prepare options for the president. Now, even in this would-be indictment, the lawyers at the Washington Post probably insisted that the reporter include the word purported. And so we're getting all wound up over accounts that include a lot of weasel words. A lot of terms that say, you know, alleged and, you know, not proven, but things that are the basis of this whole narrative that have not been established. So let's turn to some of the critical commentary all the way from Australia. Caitlin Johnstone, published at Consortium News today, talks about how the American narrative is permitted to flourish even when it doesn't have actual facts. And she opens with a quote from an interview of John Bolton. It's 10 years old, but Bolton was there with the fawning Fox host Andrew Napolitano, and Bolton is quoted, "Now, I want to make the case for secrecy in government when it comes to the conduct of national security affairs." He said, you know, Winston Churchill said that during World War II, that in wartime, truth is so important it should be surrounded by a bodyguard of lies. Napolitano, do you really believe that? Bolton, absolutely. Napolitano, you would lie in order to preserve the truth? Bolton, if I had to say something I knew was false to protect American national security, I would do it. And so Johnstone later says, this is why you will see leaders in African nations sentenced to prison by the International Criminal Court for war crimes, but the USA can get away with actually sanctioning ICC personnel if they so much as talk about investigating American war crimes and suffer no consequences for it whatsoever. She also says, we haven't been shown any hard evidence for Russians paying bounties in Afghanistan, and we almost certainly never will be. This doesn't matter as far as the imperial propagandists are concerned. They know they don't need actual facts to get this story believed. They just need narrative control. All the propagandists need to do is say over and over again that Russia paid bounties to kill the troops in Afghanistan in an increasingly assertive and authoritative tone, and after a while, people will start assuming it's true, just because the propagandists have been doing this. And at Mint Press News, Alan McLeod takes a much closer look at the reporting. He said, first, they appear all to be based entirely on the same intelligence officials who insist on anonymity. The official could not provide any concrete evidence nor establish that any Americans had actually died as a result. And then he quotes Scott Horton over at antiwar.com. After all we've been through, we're supposed to give anonymous intelligence officials in the New York Times the benefit of the doubt on something like this? I don't think so, says Horton. All three stories were written in language conceding they did not know if the story was true. They are reporting the fact that there was a rumor. Horton, continuing, there were claims in 2017 that Russia was arming and paying the Taliban, but then the generals admitted to Congress they had no evidence of either. In a humiliating debacle also in 17, CNN claimed a big scoop about Putin's support for the Taliban when furnished with some photos of Taliban fighters with old Russian weapons. The military veteran journalists at Task and Purpose quickly debunked every claim in their piece. And then he quotes Joanne Leon from the Around the Empire podcast. The bottom line for me is that after countless Russiagate-related anonymous intelligence leaks, many of which were later proven false or never substantiated with real evidence, I can't take this story seriously. The intelligence community itself can't agree on the credibility of this information. And later, McLeod writes, the timing of the leak also raised eyebrows. Peace negotiations between the U.S. and Taliban are ongoing. Trump committed to pulling all American troops out of the country, and he clearly wants to do it before the election. A number of key anti-weapons of mass destruction treaties between the U.S. and Russia are currently expiring, and a scandal like this one would scupper any chance at peace. And so, if we're looking for a logical motive, it's hawks in the Pentagon and the intelligence community who want to keep an American presence in Afghanistan. And Danny Scherson, the military veteran who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan theaters, he writes at antiwar.com in a very derisive tone, He says, well, look, you thought America capable of making a mess and miring in the morass of Afghanistan all by itself. Blasphemy, he declares. 2 decades of military stalemate teetering towards outright defeat. A highly corrupt and perceptibly illegitimate imposed partner, Kabul cabal, that still lacks sufficient money to pay its own soldiers. An indelible adversary that won't quit. Plus 2,219 dead Americans and who knows how many, well, at least 140,000 vanquished Afghans. Yes, apparently Putin was behind all, or forgive me, much of it. So, he uses sarcasm to try to dispatch this, and then he gets a little serious. He said, look, nobody, even we Russian assets and Putin apologists in their right mind, wants to see more Afghan outbound flag-draped coffins. Nor is there much of a caucus favoring foreign actors paying for American soldier scalps. And sure, we don't really know whether Moscow's GRU actually did the now mainstream media swallowed deed. Point is, there's plenty cause for sensible skepticism. Surely just a short list of now infamous touchstone terms, WMD, Libya, collusion, should be enough justification for caution. The same intelligence says that's quoted, the same quote-unquote intelligence says that's quoted in the New York Times headline has done a whole lots of sayings on every one of these super spook fiascos. So I encourage skepticism. I realize that, as Caitlin Johnstone points out, the chorus of the corporate media is so loud and singing in harmony that it makes you want to just fall in line and say, well, that must be true. And because Trump is acting so bizarrely and defensively and not even using this to divert from the coronavirus bungling, and because of his coziness with Putin and attempts to, you know, stay close to him, all that tends to lead us away from rational thought. And I, for one, remain committed to following facts, if we ever see any actual facts. So it's a pretty lonely day for Mike Pompeo playing Secretary of State, visiting the United Nations Security Council. And he's making this bizarre pitch. The United States, which violated and departed from the six-nation nuclear deal with Iran, wants to keep alive one component of the deal that we scuttled. And he wants the Security Council to extend an arms embargo on Iran that is due to expire in mid-October. But it's clear that China and Russia will reject this, but so do Britain, France, and Germany. And so Pompeo tried to make this pitch a demand, and representatives of the European countries voiced unease at both the expiration of the embargo and the American approach, which they flatly opposed. So this leads to further destruction of American influence, respect for the United States, and I'm glad to see that there are saner people on the UN Security Council who are willing to say no to the United States. We've been talking more and more about the Boogaloo Boys, this fringe group of heavily armed individuals who seem to want a revolution and, serious street skirmishes just for the fun of it. Well, yesterday, Facebook announced that they are taking down hundreds of pages and accounts of Boogaloo-related individuals or groups. But Facebook has allowed this to continue and profited from their advertising for quite some time. And the Department of Homeland Security has publicly denied that the Boogaloo movement is right-wing. They say that Antifa is definitely left-wing, when I consider it much more anarchist. And I would put the Boogaloos more in an anarchist zone. But they do appear to have some right-wing beliefs, along with some general anti-police sentiments. And some of them sport the Hawaiian shirts, call themselves members of the Mujahideen. But as of April, there were more than 100 Boogaloo groups on Facebook with a total of more than 72,000 members. And Facebook claims that they removed 100 of them from 300 Facebook and Instagram accounts. Many are similar groups. But BuzzFeed, after the purge, discovered that at least one Boogaloo outfit was still online and still advertising. It was based on an account called Doc's Custom Knives at Instagram. They placed an ad advocating that people join the militia, fight the state. And then it had a video clip with music blaring that says, "We ain't scared of no police. We got guns, too." BuzzFeed says this ad is just one of several pieces of paid content related to the Boogaloo movement on Facebook and Instagram, undercovered by BuzzFeed, after Facebook announced that all of these groups had been purged. So, this is disturbing. Facebook, for a long time, allowed people to trade guns on its pages. And the way it is set up, because you have to be a friend, you have to be invited, or you have to request to be invited to join a group, it operates with all these silos so that we don't have any idea of what the Boogaloo boys are doing on Facebook if we are not somehow connected to them. And so this kind of negligence on the part of Facebook, its selective tolerance of groups that at least have some linkage to Donald Trump. And I'll note separately that Twitter has tried to delete the account of Mint Press News and over 60,000 followers without any real explanation. These social media operators are really changing the chemistry. And not for the better. Not to promote understanding and dialogue, but to allow these groups to recruit and to disseminate their ideologies, which appear pretty dangerous to me. Well, we've got some election results from last week in Kentucky. I'm sorry to report that Charles Booker did not prevail in the Democratic primary over the well-funded former Marine fighter pilot Amy McGrath. And McGrath is another one of these conservative Democrats running against Mitch McConnell. And one of the main, before there were interstates, the highway through Kentucky was the Dixie Highway. And on that Dixie Highway, there are lots of roadkill of the conservative Democrats who tried to challenge Mitch McConnell. And while, of course, a black progressive might seem like an impossible candidate to beat McConnell in Kentucky, I submit that you need that kind of extreme contrast. Trying to stick to the middle, and Amy McGrath has been found to, when she's talking to conservative groups, make noises that are conciliatory to Donald Trump. It's like that guy who ran for the Senate in West Virginia as a nominal Democrat, but talked about how much he loved Trump and how he'd vote with Trump as often as he could. Now, a similar problem developed in Colorado, where John Hickenlooper, who is a hopeless corporate conservadem, faced a strong challenge from Andrew Romanoff, a former state House speaker. And Romanoff narrowly lost, even following the self-inflicted damage that Hickenlooper committed in the final month of the campaign. And just a little bit of good news from Oklahoma. Voters narrowly approved expanding Medicaid coverage to at least 200,000 lower-income adults, embracing Obamacare as the Republicans continue their determination to kill it off. A federal appeals court has reinstated voter suppression restrictions in Wisconsin that were a product of the previous Republican administration. So the ruling reinstates a Republican-backed law that allows local election officials to offer only 2 weeks of early voting. In cities like Madison and Milwaukee, they had planned to offer 6 weeks of early voting. Judge Frank Easterbrook wrote that the voting restrictions were acceptable because Republicans did it based on politics and not on race. Now, that just sounds like such bullshit to me. Because how do you separate the fact that in Wisconsin, most blacks vote with the Democratic Party? And so, if you impose restrictions on Democrats, how can you claim that there is not at least some implicit discrimination? Well, that's the kind of backflips that you get from some federal judges. And I don't know much about this guy, Frank Easterbrook. He might be a very fine man, but his decision sure sucks. Here's today's COVID-19 daily update prepared by Linda Lewis. Worldwide statistics, 10.5 million confirmed cases, 512,000 deaths. Across the United States, the numbers are climbing of confirmed cases every day, 2.6 million with 127,000 deaths. California has broken its daily record. And we'll get to the problems down the road from me at San Quentin here shortly. 8,000 new COVID-19 cases reported yesterday, and the governor is closing the beaches in Southern California during the long 4th of July holiday weekend. In Texas, a new top number, 7,000 new cases reported on Tuesday. The previous record was about 6,000. Governor Greg Abbott is explaining in a recent interview that Texas should have slowed efforts to reopen some businesses, including bars. So he's getting a little humility. If I could go back and redo anything, it probably would have been to slow down the opening of bars. Yesterday, on Capitol Hill, Dr. Fauci said that we are not in total control, that's an understatement, suggested that it won't be long before we're seeing 100,000 new infections each day. And this comes as we are seeing a reduction in deaths, but the rate of hospitalization is escalating, reaching a critical level in some states. And Linda points out that this is occurring at a time when July 1st is the new budget year for many state governments, and that this is leading to layoffs and reductions in spending on public health departments. Since 2010, spending for state public health departments has decreased by 16% per capita, and spending for local health departments down by 18%. At least 38,000 state and local public health jobs have disappeared since the 2008 recession. More than three-quarters of Americans live in states that spend less than $100 per person per year on public health. $32 a year in Louisiana, $263 a year in Delaware. And in most cases, the money represents less than 1.5% of states' total spending. Public health workers are leaving in droves. At least 34 state and local public health leaders have announced their resignations, retired or been fired in 17 states since April. Here's an example of an overworked public health official in Lucas County, where Toledo is located in Ohio. 42-year-old Jennifer Gottschalk works for the county as an environmental health supervisor. When the coronavirus struck, the county's department was so short-staffed that her duties included overseeing campground and pool inspections, rodent control, sewage programs, also while, you know, managing a pandemic in a community of nearly 500,000 people. When Gottschalk and five colleagues got the COVID-19, she found herself fielding calls from her hospital bed and then working through her home isolation. And there's some fair and balanced coverage here. The Affordable Care Act established the Prevention and Public Health Fund, which was championed by former Iowa Senator Tom Harkin. And it was supposed to reach $2 billion a year by 2015, but the Obama administration and Congress raided it to pay for other priorities, including a payroll tax. And Harkin, who is a nice man I've interviewed a couple of times, said he was furious when the Obama White House stole these billions, breaking what he said was an agreement. And he said, "I haven't spoken to Barack Obama since." And in my city of birth, Cincinnati, Ohio, the chair of the primary care board, Robert Brown, wants to know why cops and firefighters haven't had similar furloughs, or why residents are willing to pay hundreds of millions in taxes over decades for the Bengals football stadium. Well, misplaced priorities are not a new thing in Cincinnati, I'll tell you that. The United States, taking care of number one, ugly America does it again, has bought up virtually all the stocks for the next 3 months of one of the two drugs that has shown some proof to work against COVID-19. That's remdesivir. Alex Azar of Health and Human Services says President Trump has struck an amazing deal to ensure Americans have access to the first authorized therapeutic for COVID-19. To the extent possible, we want to ensure that any American patient who needs remdesivir can get it. That will not win friends or influence people outside the United States. The first 140,000 doses have all been used up. The Trump administration has now purchased more than 500,000 doses, which is all of the production by Gilead for July and 90% for August and September. And Linda says, "The fact that other nations impose price limits, which the U.S. does not, means Gilead profits by selling exclusively to the U.S. There are more than 300 cases now of the inflammatory syndrome that affects children. In one of the studies led by researchers at Boston Children's Hospital, 80% of the kids who developed the condition required intensive care, 20% required mechanical ventilation, and 2% died. That was a total of 4 children in that case. And American Airlines, which I never liked to begin with, is now on my shit list because they have joined United in saying that if people buy the middle seat, we're going to sell it to them. And it's fair to say that there is no federal set of rules to tell the airlines just how much they can pack the planes. And the airlines are arguing, well, you know, whether the middle seat is filled or not, whether somebody's breathing on you or not, you can't get no social distancing in an airliner, so why even try? You know what Palantir is? It's owned by Peter Thiel, Republican, Silicon Valley, rich guy. Well, Palantir has been engaged by the Health and Human Services Department to track the spread of the coronavirus, drawing the concern of a number of Democratic lawmakers. And what's at issue here is that in previous projects, when Palantir got involved, for example, information that HHS had was shared with ICE. And so when it comes to sensitive data on whether you tested positive or not, for example, and trusting your information to Palantir is probably a pretty bad bet. No indication that any changes will be made. And I'll note that Joe Biden recently hired a woman as a top advisor. I can't summon her name right now. But she has many credentials, and one of them was that she served on the board of Palantir. And just as Biden put her on his campaign, she scrubbed the references on her her resume. The Trump administration is waiving the public's right to affordable coronavirus treatments, and this ties in with what we've been describing about capturing the market on Gilead's pricey remdesivir drug. And in this article under the byline of Sharon Lerner at The Intercept, they note that the government has failed to include intellectual property and pricing protections in at least four contracts for drugs to combat COVID-19. The omissions make it more likely that potentially life-saving treatments and vaccines may be priced out of reach. So instead of using standard federal contracts, they omitted the key phrase on reasonable terms, which enables the drug companies to use unreasonable terms. And given the opportunity, you can be sure that they will. One question that's been on my mind for a while is whether the protests, either the gun-toting white people who demanded that we reopen the country in April and May, or the Black Lives Matter protests in May and June, if those would lead to a spike in reported positive testing. And it turns out that so far, there is no indication that that's happening. There have been tests in New York. And one of the arguments is that when you're outdoors, the transmission rate is much lower. A study in Japan based on a review of 110 cases found the odds of transmission 18 times higher in closed environments. Well, if that's the case, why do we have to close the beaches? Are they these heavy transmission zones? Do people, get under blankets and pass it to each other? There are, logical issues that need to be examined here. In Minnesota, an initiative that targeted demonstrators found that only 1.5% of them tested positive. In Massachusetts, fewer than 3% of protesters showed positives. That's a pleasant surprise. The unpleasant one is coming from San Quentin State Prison, just a half mile from me here in California. Made the New York Times today. We've been seeing a lot of coverage in the local media. There were no inmates known to have the virus at the beginning of May. And then the brilliant people who run the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation transferred 120 prisoners from Chino in Southern California to San Quentin. Now, they say that all those guys had been tested, but when you ask them more specifically, they said, about 3 weeks before we shipped them. And it has spread through San Quentin like wildfire. More than 1,000 of the 3,700 prisoners have since been infected. And the fear factor is immense. And I have to say that Governor Newsom, who's done some good things on prison policy, including suspending the death penalty as long as he's governor, has really failed on prisons and on senior facilities, including nursing homes, where we've seen widespread transmission of the virus. And in the case of nursing homes, 42% of the fatalities in California. As you know, we've got funds in the Peter B. Collins Community Fund. And I got a referral today from our listener, Andrea, who's in Washington State. And she and her husband have an organic farm. and John the farmer has been helping them out, growing organic food, distributing it through the Family Works program in Seattle. And so I am authorizing today a $100 grant to John the farmer to support that work and help defray some of the costs of organic farming and the distribution of the proceeds. If you could use $100 to help you through these tough times, drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. We've only turned down one request so far. This is, schadenfreude? The collapse of Chesapeake Energy, one of the pioneers of the U.S. shale industry, and the frackers, who at one point attracted funding from Wall Street and had a market cap of $38 billion, Chesapeake Energy has collapsed. Amid the glut of oil, the drop in the price, and they don't admit this, but the diminishing returns from fracking. Well, first, the Oklahoma-based company paid out $25 million in bonuses to executives and then told investors this week it has entered Chapter 11 bankruptcy with $9 billion worth of debt. And finally, today, the Committee to Protect Journalists has identified the 10 most urgent cases of threats to press freedom around the world. There are many deserving people on this list, led by Maria Ressa in the Philippines. She's been convicted by a Manila court for telling the truth about Duterte and the extrajudicial killing of many people in the Philippines since he became president. Then there's a reporter in Kyrgyzstan, Aziman Askarov, in Egypt, Solafa Magdi, in Yemen, a group of four reporters, in Burundi, Jean Bigirimana, in Mexico, Norma Sarabia Garduza, in Egypt, Mohamed Monir, in Cameroon, Samuel Wazizi, in Russia, Abdul Mumin Gadziev, and in Saudi Arabia, long after he was executed, Jamal Khashoggi. No mention of Julian Assange and the plight he faces, assuming, as we can, that Britain is likely to extradite him to the United States sometime in the next year or so. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.